Kevin, are you going to fall asleep? How long have you been in the bubble? Are you still with us? Yeah. Martin, are you still okay? What's happening with you?
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, where are we? About day 22 or something in the bubble, I think. And no, but we're hanging in there. It's been, the curling's been fantastic. So it's been okay, actually. But I am tired of my room and being in it like a lot of hours of every day.
Warren, how are you doing? You did the wraps all this week. What's going on with you?
It's good. Weather out here right now is fabulous. So it's been a good week.
You always tell me that, Warren, okay? You always tell me the weather's great. You know, I'm sick of it, Kevin. Tell Warren. Yeah, it's 25 degrees here. It's 25 degrees. Come back to Edmonton, okay? And toughen up. Let's get rolling. We got to put together another show. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Here we go.
Last rock. Eighth end. Up by two.
Should be all there. I don't think I'm white.
I don't think you are either.
Oh,
it's clean.
Oh,
don't kill it, Ben. Don't kill it.
Line's really good. Line's good. Right on the button, guys. Right
here. Last stone for Kevin Martin. They want it on the button. The sweepers are watching it. Fans are on their feet. Kevin Martin goes out as a champion. Cuts him to one. He will win his final Grand Slam, taking the Players' Championship. Talk about putting an exclamation mark at the end of a career. All he had to do was cut him down. Kevin Martin can celebrate. He is a champion.
Okay, boys, here's what's coming up on the show today. We've got packed. It's packed, and we got a special guest, but each of you guys is going to give us your general impression of what's happened this week with the Humpties Grand Slam in Calgary, of course. There was a slight adjustment to some of the rules there, in particular the tick zone. We want to know what's going on there. We just went through the World Men's Championship, and this past week, a Grand Slam event made up of internationally ranked teams. Might there be room for a new international type of competition? We're going to talk about that. And of course, our Facebook group is very active. And Warren is going to bring us up to speed on all that. And we have an unbelievable guest coming on the program today. Rachel Homan is going to join us. Kevin, let's get to you first. You're still in the bubble, but there's tons and tons of curling going on. Kevin, why don't you give us your thoughts on what happened this week at the Humpties?
Yeah, well, the Humpties Champions Cup was a fantastic event, and it was kind of neat to watch some of the teams that hadn't played a lot, like Tabitha Peterson from the U.S., her first game of the year, of the season, of the entire season, was the first game in the Champions Cup. So, you know, there's lots of that where some of the teams that had come from the Scotties or the Brier or mixed doubles, of course, had played some, but the international teams that came in, a lot of them hadn't curled yet. So that was really neat. Obviously, the no noise in the crowd when these big shots are being made by the very best competitors in our sport. And then you can hear a pin drop. Like, that was weird for me being in the building and in the commentator booth. That was strange. One thing that's kind of neat, though, with the Champions Cup is we got the ratings when it came to the Scotties and the Brier, and they were down across the board. We talked about that a few weeks ago. So I was worried when it came to the slams. Okay, what's going to happen? Like, is this something that's going to happen everywhere? So if we look back at the last slam, that was January of 2020, and the one before that, December of 2019, the ratings for the Humpties Champions Cup this week were about 9% up across the board. So good. Yeah, like, they're not sky high, but 9% up is, you know, that's a very positive a jump. So I think if we want to kind of wrap up sort of how the Champions Cup went, I would say it went very well. We had terrific games in the semifinals and finals, and ratings were strong. So our fans loved it. Great. Huge success.
Before we bring Warren in to get his reaction on the week, Kev, I got a question for you. What do the Grand Slam events mean, Kevin? Break it down. And I don't mean emotionally for the teams. I mean statistically. How important is it to win these events? Does it qualify you for bigger events? Can you get to the Olympic trials because of Grand Slams? Can you get to your national championships, Briars or Scotties? Break it all down for us, Kevin, and tell us what it means.
So that's interesting. So yes, there's a difficulty of field and the prize money. So with the Grand Slams, of course, having a big prize money and the absolute most difficult field, because to get in, you have to be the top. It's only the top 12 that get in. off the women and the men. So that's it. So when it comes to getting points on the tour, this is where I think the angle you're coming from, that'll get you into your provincials at the different provincials across the country. Well, it can get you in the national championships too, because now the top ranked teams also get in. So the slams are absolutely huge for all the teams internationally and Canadian, as far as where they fit in the pecking order in their particular country, province, whatever the case may be. So that's why the top teams, they just don't say no to slams. They always compete, because the winning of points is worth so much. And I think that's really important. Now, obviously, winning the slams, it's the best against the best. You know, that's how you prove where you fit in our sport, is when every top team is in the event and you win it. Obviously, you've climbed to the top of the heap for that week. Not a lot different than golf or tennis in that way.
Do you ever see it going bigger than six events, Kevin?
The four major events, the Canadian Open, the National, the Players' Championship, and the Masters, that's your big four. Can you see the Grand Slam property involving more events? Sure, why not? There's no problem with that. But the four major events, I don't see that changing anytime soon, like it is in tennis, like it is in golf.
And if people don't know this, Kevin, this was your invention.
Well, that goes back a long time. Yeah, you know, it's L. Clouston and myself, we started the thing called the West Edmonton Mall Curling Classic. And it worked. We sold the building out, and we had black tie served food and drinks in the crowd. And it was an idea that nobody had ever done. And it worked. And then we brought in Wild Bill Hunter as a partner and expanded even bigger into the Flexicoil event in Saskatoon. And then that kind of all shut down. Bill, unfortunately, got cancer, and that all kind of went away. But one thing it proved to me, that the idea of playing for money in arena settings made sense as a business model. So then, yes, myself and I got together with the president of IMG Canada, Kevin Albrecht, in 1997, and I just told him this crazy idea I had, and he loved it, and that's how it all started back in the late 90s.
Warren, you were at home, of course, watching this on TV. What'd you think of the whole week?
Thought it was a great week of curling. I would suggest some of the most spectacular shots I've ever seen were made in that week, and I can remember one in particular when Botcher lost to Mowat in the semifinal game, and this 20-foot angle raise takeout for the win was probably the shot of the week.
Last try, Bruce Mowat, eighth end, trailing by one. Bobby Labby digging in. The bump, is it enough?
C.
It rolls.
Hard, you gotta go. Gotta go.
Come on. Oh, boy.
And it's enough.
Great shot.
No kidding.
What a shot. Takes two and wins. Wow.
Oh, boy.
What a scrub. What a finish to hold and get the win.
Makes contact with Shotstone, and there's the question. Can you hold it? And it holds only by a few inches. The weight was the key. Great shot.
And I just saw the look in Botcher's face when they made that. It was just sort of like it drained everything out of him, but just a lot of great shots. I thought another interesting thing with the Grand Slam event, Sportsnet has developed a little different way of coverage. They've come up with an approach they call around the rings, where you actually see the shots made by the skips and the final of every end of every game. And so you're not just concentrating on one game, you're seeing everything. I really like the concept. I think it's fantastic, because you now know what's going on every sheet of ice. You're not waiting for some point in time that there's going to be a summary done. And I think it's a way of the future. Interesting, on our Facebook group, a lot of people really love it. Some don't. And I think primarily those who don't, maybe a little older, because again, they're stuck on watching one game from start to finish. But I like the around the rings concept, and you'll be seeing that again this week with the Players' Championship.
You don't hand them out easily, Warren. Compliments, okay? You're tough. You're a tough-skinned guy. And yet, talking earlier before we came on air, you are completely amazed and have this newfound respect for Team Scotland.
Yeah, those guys are fabulous. And Kevin and I were having a little chat earlier today. We think that, Mowat and Botcher are going to be the two teams in the years ahead that are going to be fighting out for most of this stuff because of their age and because of their abilities. I'm sure there's going to be some others there, but both those guys are going to be very, very hard to beat moving into the next 5 to 10 years.
What are you telling your son, Kev, in these weeks?
Yeah, my advice to those guys is just enjoy it. They got to be having a blast. Like, they're doing well. You don't win every event you're in. But to get to finals and give it your best go against another team that's on fire, and, you know, they just got outplayed by Team Mode in that final, but they just won the Brier. And, you know, yeah, they're doing great. I just said, just enjoy yourself. Just, you know, and here you are going into the Players' Championship. Well, battle again. Have fun.
The amazing thing with both those teams, when you listen to them on the RF mics, nothing scares them. Every shot that you can take a look at and you're going to yourself, wow, that's pretty difficult. They just take a look at it as if, yeah, we're going to make this. And they usually do. So it's quite amazing to watch.
One of the things that happened in this event, Kevin, there was an adjustment made to the rules this past week in regard to the tick zone. Tell us all about that, Kev.
Well, the idea is that watching the, be it the Brier, Scotties, Worlds, whatever the case may be, even early in the game, the second or third end, teams would start to tick the rocks off the center when they had last rock. And it takes a lot of the entertainment out of those ends because now, you know, it's wide open and it's either a blank or whatever the case may be. So I know the World Curling Federation is interested in this idea of a no-tick zone. Curlers definitely are. So if the lead throws it on the center line, if the rock is touching the center line, you couldn't move it off the center line until the sixth rock of the end. It had to stay there. So what happens is when you're coming home and you're trying to steal, you throw the first two rocks on the center line with a great deal of distance between them, and they can't start hitting them until the sixth rock. Woohoo! There's a lot of action. And it turned out to be more steals. I'm actually waiting to hear from Jerry Gertz, who looks after all the stats, of exactly how many more steals. I'll bring that to you next week, I promise, on our next podcast. But there were definitely more steals. And do all players like that? Nope, not all. But I know as a fan, with a no-tick zone, I'm not going to turn away. Because I know, there's a chance they could steal. Whereas in the regular curling where you can tick off the rocks with two good teams, you're down to about an 8% or 13% chance to steal. And that's not very much of a chance. And therefore, I think we lose a lot of viewership. And that's not good for our game.
So safe to say, Kevin, that someone's first rock, they're going to keep it on the center line all the time?
No, not all the time. It depends on the scoreboard. If you need to steal, you will. If you're, you know, tied up or winning, you'll probably throw it in the house. So it's a strategic ploy. But and it used to be the tick shot was only used late in the game. But as teams evolve, they're using it all game. And that's, in my opinion, it takes away from the entertainment value of the game early. I really like this, the tick zone. I like the way it worked last week. I thought it added quite a lot to the last, especially the last few ends of every curling game.
And if I throw up the center line, okay, first rock, Kev, my next one, I'm trying to draw into the house then? Is that how this all affects the game?
Well, maybe. Yeah, that's all the strategy of the game. It's always by the scoreboard. Like, I always skipped according to the scoreboard. Most people would. A scoreboard, that means the score and the end, what end you're in, be it even or odd, and how late in the game. So yeah, curling strategy is a lot like chess. It's a very complex thing, but to make it more exciting for the crowd, the tick zone makes sense.
What do you know? I just read you won 18 Grand Slams. What do you know? Who's closest to your record?
Glenn Howard. I believe he's at 16, but
he's coming for you.
He's coming for me, but Glenn's getting a little old. So I think,
he's just
sorry, Glenn. I know Glenn will be mad at me now, but oh well.
Warren, what's your take on the whole thing? You're looking at our Facebook group. You've always got lots to say. What do you say about this rule?
From what I could see, I think it tended to direct more play towards the center, and seemingly a number of ends built up with a lot of rocks in the house towards the center, which I think is good, because if I go back to the concept of mixed doubles when it developed, that was the whole aim, was the fact you can score multiple ends by forcing the play towards the middle. And mixed doubles has proved that to be true. And I think in a four-person game, to play towards the middle is how multiple ends are scored. Probably using corner guards, that could develop in a three, but probably not that often, more likely a two. But towards the middle, multiple points can be scored. And I think that's sort of what this thing tended to do from my observation of it. I also want to read a little email that was sent to me. Kevin and I both know this gentleman, James Dreiberg. And here was his suggestion, and I get Kevin's comment. He says, loving the no tick on the center line, but this doesn't help the team with the hammer. What about two extra lines from the edge of the 8 foot up to the hog line? If there is a guard in those lines, that can't be ticked until the sixth rock of the end has been thrown. What do you think of that one, Kevin?
Well, you saw in the 8th end of the men's final when Carrick threw up the corner guard, and they're trying to get three to come back in the game against Mowat. And Hammy, Mowat's lead, actually chipped the corner guard into the rings over by the side and rolled a shooter out. Carrick threw a corner guard, and Hammy came around, tapped it out, and in essence, the three is over. You can't get three then. So you're right. As the game evolves, James is probably right. We're probably going to need something like that. It might be a little bit soon. Like, let's let everybody swallow the tick zone first in the middle. But going forward, you're right. And that's a defense that Brad Jacobs invented about 2 years ago that Bruce Mowat has adopted. And Hammy is making that shot more than he's missing it.
So is the jury out for you, Kevin, on this new rule that they tried?
Well, the center line one, definitely. I like that. I've thought it could be a good idea for years. The corner guard one, though, not many people chip the rock into the rings. That's a very new defense strategy that Bruce Mowat has adopted from Brad Jacobs. But now that people are doing it, obviously, Leeds will practice it more, and it'll become standard practice in the next few years.
You're talking about chipping your opposition's rock into the rings, right?
Right, but you can't knock it out of play. So it's a very tricky shot, but if you practice anything enough, you'll get good at it.
So, Warren, you're yay or nay? You're good with what they tried?
From what I've seen so far, yes. And I know, again, in our Facebook group, got lots of people that are very critical of it. But it's new. It's a change. And I think the big thing with curling today, we're struggling a bit to some degree. And it has been not just happening yesterday. This goes back to the 80s. We've been struggling to make the game a little more offensive because I think we know with most sports, defense doesn't sell, offense does. And I think that's the issue with curling. And I go to mixed doubles. Mixed doubles, you can be three up and you're never out of danger. And I think the way curling has been going at the four-person level, one up with a hammer, for the most part, you're out of danger. And I think that we don't want that to become too much of an assumption. And we need things to make sure that any possibilities always exist.
The World's Men's Championship a couple weeks ago now. That was congratulations to Adin. Good job. And this week was the first Grand Slam that was made up of the top 12 internationally ranked teams. The question is, might there be room for a different type of international competition? What do you say, Warren?
Again, this is something Kevin and I have talked a lot about, and the fact that curling is the only major Olympic sport in the winter side that does not have a World Cup. And a World Cup differs from a World Championship, and the World Cup is the best players in the world, not necessarily the country becomes the attachment. It's the best players in the world. Some of the sports, like the sliding sports, they say that a country can have a maximum of three players or three athletes in the sport. Maybe that would have to happen here, but it'd be very much what we're doing right now in these Grand Slam events. They're virtually a World Cup, the way they're being run right now, because it's the 12 best teams in the world, not the 12 best countries. And the World Championships are country against country. This is virtually player against player, but you're still representing a country, but it's a slightly different approach to life. And I think into the future that a World Cup format for curling is essential, and I think it could be a huge attraction.
Do you agree, Kev?
Well, I did a little bit of homework, Jimmy. Well, I'm in the bubble, so I got lots of time to do homework. So let's think of a 16-team World Cup event where, to Warren's point, you can only have three teams from any country, okay? So if going down the current teams, you'd have your three top Canadian teams because you're only allowed three Canadian teams. You'd have Anna Hasselborg, Satsuki Fujisawa, Alina Stern, Silvana Taranzoni, Eve Muirhead, Tabitha Peterson, Minji Kim, Alina Kovaleva, Unjun Kim, Saki Yoshimura, Unju Jim, Isabella Rana, and Kuwana from Japan. You'd have three Canadians, three Japanese teams, three Korean, two Swedes, two Swiss, a Scot, U.S., and a Russian. There'd be eight nations involved in the World Cup women's. I think it would be an absolutely terrific event. And if you look at the men's, you'd have your top three Canadians, Bruce Mowat, Yannick Schraller, Nicholas Adin, Peter DeCruz, Ross Patterson, Corey Dropkin out of the U.S., Rich Roonen out of the U.S., Yuta Matsumura, Japan. Ross White is a Scot. John Schuster, Chang Min Kim from Korea, Jaap van Dorp, Netherlands, Thomas Olsrud, Norway. So you'd have three Canadians, three Scots, three U.S., two Swiss, a Japanese, Korean, Netherlands, Norway, Sweden. You'd have nine nations represented. I think the World Curling Federation would love it. You have, under today's rankings, you would have eight different nations represented in women's, nine in men's. It would be a true world championship, but it would be called the World Cup, and only the very top nations and top teams are allowed in. I think it's be absolutely fantastic.
So I get Canada has three teams. These other teams that only get one, Kevin, is that just because they don't have the depth?
But they just don't have the teams in the top.
It's world ranking.
Yeah, it's a world ranking. So the reason I say the top three Canadians, because in both men's and women's curling, we have far more than three teams in the top 16. Like we have way more than that, but only three can come. Whereas the slams are your top 12. If there's seven Canadians and three teams from South Korea and three from somewhere else, that fills up the event. I love that event because it's the best of the best. But the World Curling Federation would like to see more countries involved. So you can't have seven from one nation. That's no good for the World Curling Federation. So that's why these World Cup events in very, well, lots of sports only allow your top three from each country. So that's why I read out to you who the 16 would be, and it is terrific.
So if I'm not going to make the top three in Canada, I'm going to take my team. I'm going to go over to Switzerland. I'm going to curl there. Our Facebook group, Warren, bring us up to speed. What's going on there?
Well, we've had lots of activity on our Facebook group over this last few weeks, lots of discussions, and I invite all of you, if you aren't members, to join. Among other things, I do a daily wrap there, and when Kevin's available, he does it, but certainly he won't be doing any this week because he's busy. We've got all kinds of discussions going on, and other people are starting. There's currently one been going on about the tick zone. Lots of very vigorous comments there. The Sportsnet around the rings concept. Again, some people really like it, some not that much. Again, lots of discussion. One here I just read this morning, how far can sweepers carry a stone? Lots of opinions on that one. Another one, why has John Morris become so vocal with Kevin Cooey? Lots of comments on that one. So we invite you to join our group. We put up interesting things on occasion, including a lot of historic information, and come and join us and have some fun.
Okay, boys, like that. Quick as the whistle, we're through the show, and because we've got a fantastic guest coming up who I'm very anxious to talk to, one of the most successful curlers in the world. When we come back, Rachel Holman is in the house.
Last rock, Alina Petz for Team Tirinzoni. Eight then, needing two. Got to come off the yellow. Yellow on the red.
Oh, what a try.
What an effort, but not enough. It will be Rachel Holman back in the winner's circle at the Calgary Bubble, taking the Humpties Champions Cup.
Yay.
6-3, the final score. Holman gets her record 11th Grand Slam title. She has top of the list anyhow, and she adds one more to her total.
Oh, yes, hark. What is that? That's a knock at the door. Okay, let's see who it is. Let's open the door. Rachel Holman, come on in. How are you, Rachel?
I'm great. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good. Listen, first of all, congratulations. You, less than 24 hours ago, you win the Humpties Grand Slam. You were in the finalist in the Scotties. You're probably getting tired of this, but it's so remarkable what you've done over the last couple of months. You were 8 months pregnant when you were in the Scotties. Then you slip away to have a baby, and you come back, and you win the Humpties. I mean, that's incredible. First of all, how's the baby? Tell us name and when it was born and all that jazz. How's the child?
She's great. She was born March 25th. Her name's Bowen. And she's growing like a weed. She's eating lots and sleeping lots, as newborns do. And getting lots of snuggles in. But yeah, it's been really great, and kind of was thinking about if she came a little bit before her due date that I was looking at curling after, but not sure. You never know. Going into delivery, you can't really make any plans.
Right.
So I just thought I'd see how it goes, and wasn't sure if I could slide, but I tried it out and felt okay. So just went with it.
And sleeping through the night, not keeping you up all night?
Not even close. I got a couple 2 hour stretches once in a while, but other than that, she's eating around the clock like newborns do. So
good.
Not much sleep, but I mean, that's a part of it, right?
I'm your coach now, okay, of your team, okay? Now, you're going to have to listen to me, okay, because this is what I would first tell you right away as a coach. You've been so successful the last couple months, so you got to get pregnant every year for the next 10 years, and you're going to win everything in sight, okay? That's,
I've heard that a little bit.
Yeah, I bet you have. Before we get to Kevin's going to jump in a second, how did you possibly pull all this off over the last couple of months to be able to do this? Were you second guessing it at all to go into the Scotties and even after to come back? And I mean, most women would be off for 9 or 10 months on a normal maternity leave, but not you. How did you do it all?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's different for everybody. I mean, some people don't get any mat leave either. I'm definitely not the only one, but it, I mean, I didn't really think about it. I just told the girls that if we were in the Scotties that I'd play, and I didn't really think too much about it, but 8 months comes along and things are definitely more painful than you can anticipate. But I was still able to slide. And I mean, COVID made really challenging because normally in a curling season, you can keep sliding. And as your body changes, you can keep practicing and see how it feels. But we were off for almost 2 months as I kept getting bigger and things were changing for me. So my husband actually built a rink out in the back to see if I could slide because there was no real other option. And then I was able to slide okay. So then we went and were able to practice a couple times as a team before the Scotties, kind of here and there where it was allowed. And then the practices went well. I could only do so much because it was definitely some physical limitations and a little bit of pain. So I didn't want to push or injure myself. And so, we relied on years and years of practice and throws and our ability and our confidence. We're a new team, so definitely some growing pains and learning about sweeping and throwing and communication, all that comes with having a new team. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of had that on top of COVID and no practice and 8 months pregnant. So I'm just really proud of the team for doing as well as we did. And obviously came up a little bit short, but Anderson's a phenomenal team, and they're going to do Canada so proud. We're really excited to watch them and really happy that they're able to go to Worlds because they kind of got ripped off last year, and mm-hmm. They'll be a great representative for Canada. So we're obviously disappointed that we couldn't quite win that last game, but we'll be cheering loud here back at home while they're staying in the bubble forever, it seems like.
Rachel, what's the toughest part about being in the bubble? We've had a number of guests on during it. Kevin's been great with lining people up, and we thank you very much for coming on. We know you're busy. You got to hit the ice again tomorrow at noon for the players. Mm-hmm. What did you find the most difficult about it, or what are you finding the most difficult about it?
To be honest, I think just leaving my little guy at home has been the hardest, just being away from family, because we're so close that we would be able to bring him or see him on the road. But when you're stuck and you can't go anywhere, you feel it a little bit more maybe when you know normally that they could be here and mm-hmm. and watching and enjoying the journey and experience with you. I mean, curling's we love the game, but we also love being able to experience it with our friends and family, and I think that's been the toughest part. But other than that, it really feels like a normal event because you're so busy. I mean, the Scotties, we never really get to do much, go anywhere. We eat a lot of our meals in the room, and there's not really much time for socializing. You're just trying to recover. And then the Slams, there's a bit more downtime. Usually you can see some friends and family there. So I think that's maybe the toughest part, mm-hmm. but it doesn't seem too far out of the ordinary. We've also been in and out. So, I mean, I'm speaking to my own experience, but I know some people have been in the bubble for a lot longer. And I know I went for a walk with Val and Carrie the other day, and I can't imagine being here for 45 days. I'm here for 2 weeks and I'm missing my little guy. So everyone's experience is different. And the amount of time that you're in the bubble can definitely be challenging. Mm-hmm. But we're just all so excited that we can curl. We've been at home for a year pretty much, and weren't sure if we could compete ever again. You know, the numbers just keep going up, and things mm-hmm. are still a little bit scary as to what normal is going to look like moving forward. And this is kind of our lives. We love to compete. We love the sport, and we're hoping that things can get back to being able to compete in front of fans. But as of right now, I mean, we're just thankful. All the work is just tremendous, the amount of work that's gone into putting this on and making sure that people feel safe, and all the volunteers and all of Curling Canada and Sportsnet. We're just thankful. And so the days away, it's a part of what it takes to be here.
Well, you're competing, my friend. You're doing very well. Kevin?
How old is Riot now?
He'll be two in June. So
he'll be two in June. So yeah. So of course, being a grandpa, you always think about, you hear about baby Bowen, but we don't hear much about what Riot's thinking of having a little sister. And how he's thinking about that, being a 2-year-old.
Yeah, we weren't sure if he quite got it, but since we've been gone, he's seen her on TV and myself, and apparently he's yelling out Mom and Baby Bo. So that's been kind of cute that we kind of realized that, oh, maybe he did get it. And he mostly just points to her and laughs when she makes funny noises. So it'll take, I think, a few months for him to interact and really get it. But yeah, I think he's a little bit young, but it'll come soon.
Oh yeah, he'll get into the cuddling soon enough. Hey, so let's get into a little bit of curling here and let Warren in here in a bit. But it was a big team change, really. And to your point, you haven't had a lot of time to really get into it with the new team. And then all of a sudden you show up with the new team at the Scotties and you do so well. And then you go on to the Champions Cup and you win it. So I guess I'd love to hear your thoughts on your new front end with Sarah coming in at second and moving Joanne to lead. And I guess sort of how do you decide, because Joanne is one of the best seconds in the game, but so Sarah. So I guess how do you decide who's lead, who's second on this new setup?
Yeah, I think Sarah kind of brings that wealth of a back-end experience and the strategic mindset, and I think anyone on this team would play any position. It's going so well, and we're all just doing what we need to do to win, and that's playing whatever position is required. And Jo's really excited. She's played lead in the past and really wants to become the best lead in the world. And Sarah's gone down to second. She's previously played back end and has a lot of experience in the strategy side, and it just brings that sweeping IQ and just even another voice in for looking at different options from the other end. And it's been really great. She's fit in so well and just brings so much to the game, whether it's strategy or sweeping or throwing smarts. It's been a really, really great transition, and I think as seamless as you possibly can with a new team, with no practice, with COVID. I think we've really gelled really quickly. And I mean, obviously you're going to make mistakes and you're learning communication and you're learning different throws. And if we could have had, more training reps and more throws, we would have been able to see a little bit more technical and fine tune that. But I think everyone's on the same page where not everyone's technical is where they want it to be. And so you're throwing to make it and relying on your experience. And she has so much experience, whether it's worlds or big slam finals, she's played in it all. And so it's been really great. And she's fit in so well and such a team player. It's been a really fun experience as little time as we've had together.
You know, I just want to talk a little bit about that. It seems to me that as we're looking at the top female teams in the world, and, if you look at, for example, let's go to Einarsson, of course. Why not? The Canadian champion with such strong lead and second sweepers. Like, really strong sweepers. And then look at your team with now Sarah and Joanne. I don't even know which of the two would be stronger. They're both really strong.
Yeah.
And then you've got Esther Neuenschwander. You've got Agnes Nockenhauer on Hasselborg's team. Is there something, a bit of a, maybe a, I'm not sure, I shouldn't say change maybe, but it seems to be following almost like the men's game where the teams that are successful have brute strength, if I can say that about females.
Yeah, absolutely.
But your thoughts on that? It seems to be that it's really changed that way in the women's game, that you need that muscle up front.
Yeah, I mean, you see the men's game, and for us, we've seen them and be able to play with a little bit of their sweepers at the Connell Cup, and we're just like, how do you guys miss? They're just able to control the rock so well. Obviously, women don't have as much pressure on the broom, but if you have that extra strength and that extra gear, just makes your game that much better, and you're able to throw shots that maybe other teams can't. And so it's definitely a huge part of the game. But I think also you're seeing back end players play that second position because of the five rock rule, because of how the game has changed and the position of second has evolved. I think you almost need a back end player there, and I think that's kind of where the game is going and where our team has made that change and trying to evolve with the game and trying to stay at the top of our game has really worked well for us. And I mean, Anderson, same, you know, they all have back end players, but they've got that back end player at second as well. And you see how successful they are.
Huh. I've never heard anybody say that. That's really interesting. I've never heard that being said by anybody that, but you're right. Actually, if you think about it, I just had never thought about it. Warren?
Yes, I was certainly impressed with the sweeping ability of both the teams in the final yesterday. I thought it was excellent. And I actually made a comment in my little rap last night, and the fact that I said, really impressed with the fact that both of those teams in the ice look so athletic. And kind of makes me feel good over the times that we tried to get the image of the sport changed to be more athletic, that it has evolved to that point. Anyway, a question, Rachel. We have been toying back and forth with the fact that the five-rock rule was not allowing the chances to score that it should, and teams, particularly in the Brier, were almost completing a game with zero being on the scoreboard for their side. So last week in the Slam, a new tick rule was put into place, and the fact that if a rock was touching the center line, it couldn't be ticked off till after the fifth rock was delivered. What was your opinion of that whole thing? How did it work, and where do you think it should go?
I think it definitely worked well for the most part. I think the only time that maybe it evened the playing field as opposed to give... If you play an 8-end game or a 10-end game, and you're the better team and you've controlled the game and you have Hammer coming home, you deserve to have an advantage coming home. But I think that no tick rule almost takes that advantage away. We saw quite a few steals in the men's game last end and then again in the extra end for the win. And you never see that because the better team has taken control of the game and they're able to make the ticks and draw for their one and win the game. But you see a little bit more upsets there where that advantage is taken away. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think it depends on where we want to take the game. If we want to move it towards more of a skins type play and just you got to make all your shots at every end, especially the last ones. We could take the game there for sure. Yeah, it's definitely a good topic for discussion.
Yes, I'm sure it's going to be discussed a lot in the weeks and months ahead. And I found it interesting. I thought to a very large degree, it seemed to force a lot of the play to the middle, more so than usual, more like to some degree mixed doubles. Mm-hmm. But interesting for sure. And I'm sure that we're going to talk a lot about it in the weeks ahead. Another question. You played mixed doubles a bit. And if my memory is correct, you were supposed to play with John Morris going into the 2018 Olympics. Were you not, by my memory?
Yeah. Yes.
And then, of course, you got into the four-person side, and John teamed up with another partner and won a gold medal. So now we're heading towards 2018. Do you have any plans to give mixed doubles a shot again for the 2022 games?
Yeah. I mean, John and I were going to play in nationals this year, but obviously I don't think I could have played right at 9 months for mixed doubles sweeping.
Well, why not? What the heck?
I was watching it. I was watching the mixed doubles and I was like, oh, it's painful to watch and not compete when, you know, you just want to be there. And I was like, oh, I totally could have. And, you know, she's not here yet. But then I went into labor between the semi and the final. So I was like, I wouldn't have made it.
Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah.
No. But yeah, it was fun to watch. And I love to compete. And mixed doubles is a ton of fun. And John and I have had lots of success together. And we have a spot in the mixed doubles trials. And I'm looking forward to playing with him and trying to see if we can be at the top of the podium that week.
This is a crazy schedule because of the bubble that they're putting it, you know, all together. Of course, there's just been one event after another, and we're not done yet. Warren's brought up some good points over the shows about the scheduling of events in curling. Do you think there should be a big break with curling, with you know, 2 or 3 months off like other sports, or would you consider that maybe it should go all year round? What's your take on that?
I think a break is always a good thing. Yeah, even just for injuries and recovery. I think we play a lot as curlers, and comparing other sports, we have a lot more games compared to times that we're able to practice, mm-hmm. because often we go back-to-back events and sometimes we go 3 in a row. I mean, injuries start to creep in when things like that happen, and a little bit of burnout and fatigue. And so, yeah, I think it's a good topic of discussion. If you had more breaks in between events and it went all year round, that might work. But I think people enjoy the time off for a few months and able to put in some off ice training and fix some injuries and tend to some things that you need to. I mean, just like any sport has an off season, that's a good thing. You need a mental break, and there's other things in life as well. It's not to just eat, sleep, sports. But yeah, I think we could definitely look at less competition and more breaks in between that. I mean, you saw the success and the high level of curling, and we had mm-hmm. so many months off, and nobody was really able to practice even, but you saw lots of curlers that didn't quite miss a beat, and such amazing games at the Scotties and the Brier back and forth and big battles, and you wouldn't have known that these curlers hadn't been competing all year. And so, I mean, the bigger break in between events might lead to better play and less injury. And at the end of the day, I mean, people are trying to run events, and we want to support them, and we want to be at all the slams, and we want to be at all the TSN events. So there's not many places that you can decline. And so it just depends on how the schedule looks. But I don't know what that's going to look like with COVID moving forward. It will be interesting to see.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it, isn't it, going forward to this fall? But I sure agree with you with the makeup of the season and how do we do it. And of course, as you know, somebody like me who played for 1,000 years, injuries are a huge problem if you play too much.
Yeah.
And you're right, Rachel. I just don't know if it should be bigger breaks between or the summertime or, you know, the off season, if you want to call it summertime or whatever the case may be. Olympics. Oh, I would really like to get into your mindset a little bit about how you feel about that, because the first Olympics I went to in 1992, we didn't get on the podium. And I don't think there's like a day that went by where I didn't think I couldn't wait to get back to another Olympic Games, because once you get a taste of it, it's so different than any other sporting event in the whole world. I'd like to hear your thoughts, because obviously the Olympics didn't go the way you wanted the first time. And, you know, you're obviously a favorite to get back there again. What do you think? Well, how does your mind work with wanting to get back to the Olympic Games?
I mean, same as your mindset, really. When you're a competitor and you want to be at the top of your game always, the Olympics always stands out as wanting to be the best in your sport in the world. And just the pinnacle of being on the podium at the Olympics and getting a gold medal is something everyone dreams of. And I mean, becoming an Olympian is a great accomplishment, but obviously we want more, and we want more for Canada and more for ourselves. But as you saw kind of at men's worlds, it's a tough field. The world has stepped up and there's no easy games. Everyone's gunning for Canada. Everyone's gunning for everybody at this point. Everyone is so good. You look across the board. I mean, 20 years ago, it wasn't the case. There wasn't as many curlers, and there wasn't as much funding or emphasis put on the curling programs of other countries. But since then, I mean, they've just put everything into the game, and you got to bring your A game every time. I think Botcher, and I was talking with Brendan and Darren a bit, and they said the Maple Leaf target is a real thing. Everyone plays up to you, and the games where you think, okay, this might be a little bit easier, and they throw everything at you, and it's tough. But I mean, I'm up for the challenge. I want to be there. I want to be representing Canada. I want the Maple Leaf on our back, and we're going to do everything we can to get there, and then to bring our absolute best. And we're excited and getting ready, and hopefully with COVID and everything, that we're able to have that opportunity, and hopefully trials happens, and it would be amazing if there were fans in the stands, but obviously all that is just an unknown right now.
Well, it's the one thing for you left to do, win the Olympic gold, Rachel. I thought I was looking at the wrong thing this morning when I was checking you out on Wikipedia. And, you know, there's a bunch of stuff on there. You know, of course, your slam records and all this, and, you know, a million accomplishments that you've done. But it said your first curling team was in 2002. And then I did the math. You just turned 32, I think, in April. Is that right?
I can't even remember.
Your birthday?
I'm so sleep deprived. I can't even remember. I was hoping I turned 30, but I think you're right. I think I turned 32.
Okay. So when I do the math,
that's perfect.
When I do the math, you were they're showing your first curling team when you were like 11 years old that you curled, and I said, I've got to ask her, were you just doing it back then? Was it just something you wanted to try? I mean, you're hardly old enough to make any decisions, but you did this. And at what point in your long career? Early on, did you look at this thing saying, okay, I'm going to take curling on? When you started curling, was it always going to be curling? And if so, when? At what point in your life did you decide to compete?
Yeah, I played all kinds of sports growing up, and curling was always there. And kind of when you get to that age of 11, 12, 13, you have to make a decision, and sports start becoming year-round, and you have to make a commitment to one over multiple. I mean, I still played other sports for fun, and in the off season still did some hobbies, but yeah, around that age started taking it a little bit more seriously. And I mean, it's not like I was 11 and gunning for the Scotties. I was 11 and we were excited to put a team together and see if we could win some games. And I played with Emma right away. Mm-hmm. And the first field that we played, I think we won. So that was a good sign of things to come. Since then, we just kept curling together and kept trying to find people that were putting curling as a top priority. And we kind of just chose kind of even our university and school routes around mm-hmm. curling and always put curling first. I mean, education is super important. And I've since done 2 degrees, but done it at a leisurely pace so that I'm able to curl and compete the way I wanted to. Mm-hmm. And evolve as a player and as a person. And obviously family is right up there, and obviously being number one, but being able to juggle that and have the support. And we're lucky enough to have coaches and support staff and family that were able to support us in our journey to be able to be where we are today. I don't know at what point we kind of looked, I mean, through your juniors, you're always just looking. I think we just kind of stayed where we were. So in juniors, we wanted to win juniors, whether it was provincials and then nationals, and then worlds. And once you're getting close to women's, you're starting to look at it. But at the time, I think now you can compete in both, but at the time we couldn't. Mm-hmm. And so we were always just keeping an eye on the Scotties and watching it and thinking one day maybe. And our first year out of women's, we were able to qualify for the Scotties. So that was a phenomenal feeling. And just trying to see how far we could go in the sport. And obviously the Olympics were in the back of our minds. And then as it got closer to that 2014 Olympics, we tried to see how far we could go and obviously came up short. Mm-hmm. It just lights a fire as a competitive athlete that you just want to keep pushing. And it's a 4-year cycle, so you have to wait quite a long time before that opportunity comes up again. You're just trying to prepare yourself as best you can to be at the top of your game in the right moments and hope the chips fall in the right way. And you need to be as best prepared as you can. You need a little bit of luck and lots of hard work, and hopefully things work out. But we'll see. There's bigger things happening right now and with the global pandemic. So that's the number one. We want everyone to stay safe.
Earl Morris was involved with a lot of your career, and particularly as a junior, and I think into women's curling. When did Earl become involved with you, and was he involved in putting your junior teams together, and how'd that all work out? How'd all that come to being?
Our very first team with Emma, it was just our dads that chatted, and we played in Little Rocks. I don't even know if it's called that anymore. But we played in Little Rocks against each other, and Emma's dad, Art, I think, phoned my dad to see if we could play in a tournament together and put a team together. And I think our parents kind of had more of a say in putting a team together. We didn't, we were just going out there and throwing rocks. But Earl was, I mean, the Morrises have always been family friends. My brother played with John and in juniors, and I kind of known them since I was born. And so I think they joked early and said, you know, maybe one day Earl will coach Rachel, when I was running around 4 years old in the curling club. And he was still coaching and still involved in the game. And we jumped at the opportunity when he was able to coach us right away. And he was able to kind of lay that foundation and that work ethic and the practices that you need to put in, and really instill those basics in us right from the start, and really laid the groundwork for us to evolve as players. And he was able to coach us on and off over the years. And he's definitely a big part of where we are today, and how successful we were early, and even how successful we are now. And he's always been a huge cheerleader of ours, and always get texts from him, and just like another dad. And he's just so supportive and knows so much about the game and is such an amazing coach. We're just lucky that he was able to be a part of our journey.
Rachel, we're going to let you go. Before we do, though, you've become a mentor to so many young curlers. You are, when we talk about your story earlier that you said about when you were 11, 12, 13, putting teams together. If I'm a 12 or 13-year-old and I come to you and say, I want to be just like you, what would you be telling young kids, Rachel, who want to get into the game at an early age like you did and compete?
I think to surround yourself with people and support. And I mean, if someone is offering to take you out in practice and help you in different ways, I mean, jump at every opportunity that's thrown your way. You never know what little insight or golden nuggets are there to be able to grab onto, and that might help evolve you as a player. Kind of be that yes person to jump at any opportunity, I think. And I mean, you can't get around and get away from putting in the work and putting in, you know, just the repetitions and laying the basics down of whether it's technical or going through the motions and getting that experience, right? You're going to have to lose a lot before you're going to win, and learn from those experiences and really enjoy the process and the journey. It's not always going to be wins after wins. You got to go through tough games and tough losses to be able to get to that point where you're in finals and then you start winning them. And so I think it's enjoy the journey and make sure that you're surrounding yourself with teammates that have similar goals and that you really enjoy being around and hanging out with and have fun with it. It's a fun game. It's a social game, and you kind of make friends all over the world. And it's really kind of a unique sport where we're friends with a ton of our competitors. And so it's really fun. And I've really enjoyed my journey through curling and all the people and places I've been able to travel and meet. It's been a fun journey and a fun ride, and I wouldn't have changed it. And so I think, yeah, just trying to jump in and dive into everything you can in curling is really my biggest advice.
Right on. Rachel, thanks a lot for doing this. Congratulations on, you know, an unbelievable career so far. Obviously, there's bigger and better things to come. We really appreciate you taking time. Good luck this week in the players. Congratulations on the Humpties. That's a record, 11. The next closest is 9, I think, Jennifer Jones. So you're well on your way to blasting the field with new records. So congratulations. And thanks a lot for coming on, Rachel. Good luck.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Good luck.
See you later.
Thanks, guys.
I gotta just run upstairs and get my iPad with the notes for the
Stop. I wonder what that means. That's code for something.
Yeah, there's a different
I get break out in hives enough when I hear Warren go, Jim. Okay, that just sets me off. Now I got you. Okay, now I got you almost. What did I do wrong?
Takes a lot of management.
No wonder I smoke.
Well, that was good.
Well, fellas, Warren, you've been around curling a long time. How big is that accomplishment that where she went to the finals of the Scotties, pregnant 8 months, and then has a baby and comes back and wins the Humpties? I mean, in COVID and everything. What a remarkable young girl.
Yeah, that's an amazing accomplishment, and I think it beds well for how good that team is probably that she has right now, and look out for them next year. I think Olympic trials is going to be a tough one to deny them, and be very interesting to see how it goes.
Kevin, do you see anything stopping this team?
There's three or four teams in Canada that are absolutely fantastic, and they're one of them, and the only way you can stop a train like that is if your train goes as fast, you know, for a Team Anderson or a Jennifer Jones or a Tracy Fleury. That's really the only teams that I see that when Rachel's going her best can even have a chance of keeping up. They don't have any weaknesses on their team with Emma and Sarah and Joanne. They're sweeping. They're just strong from start to finish.
Congratulations to her, and we'll be watching for sure. Kev, give us your take now. You hardly get to pause. We were going to do the show this morning, Warren, and Kevin said, no, I need to go to sleep. So we're recording in the afternoon. But Kev, right back at it today. The Grand Slam continues with the Prince's Auto Players Championship starting now. What's your take? What's going to happen there, Kev? Who are we watching for?
There's increased curl. They've actually put quite a lot more curl in the ice for the Players Championship. They definitely sanded the stones more aggressively to get more movement. So that will benefit other teams. When the ice is a little bit straighter at the start of the Champions Cup, it was different teams. So that's kind of the neat part about curling is that some people like more curl, some people like a little less. So I think playing conditions will have a lot to do with who ends up getting to the playoffs in the end. Obviously, when it comes to the very best teams, the cream usually rises no matter what, but there are teams that enjoy a little bit straighter ice, like, say, a DeCruz or even Rachel actually likes it a little bit straighter. And then the Players is going to be more curl. And that's kind of more like Bruce Mowat likes more curl. A Botcher likes more curl. A team like Terenzoni, they like it a little straighter. So, you know, teams just kind of have a preference. But the Players, I know I was talking to Carrick today after they had their practice, and the ice was moving around 7 feet. So it was curling a ton. They're going to straighten it up a little bit, but it'll be moving lots.
Warren, are you doing your wraps again this week? You doing a wrap-up?
Yes, we will be doing a wrap every day, as difficult and troublesome as it is to do all that. No, just kidding. We will be doing a wrap every day with some comments and some observations of what's going on, for sure.
Well, people love it. You're doing a great job. Thanks to everyone. Inside Curling is reaching out to curling clubs all over the world and inviting you to contact us and ask to set up a one-hour Zoom call. We'd love to do it with me and Kevin and Warren to discuss anything you'd like. We've done well over half a dozen of these now, and people love it. You can email us, insidecurling@gmail.com, and we're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as well. Also, we'd like to thank a number of people, including Amal, okay, who produces the show, and now he's straightening me up, okay, Warren? He's starting to take over from you and giving me crap all the time.
Yeah, taking some of the weight off my shoulders.
Yeah, he is. Let's thank Rod Paulson and his company, In-House Strategies, for all the great work he's doing on our social media. People love it, and we thank Rod for doing that. It's great. We love it, and it's very active. And thanks a lot to Sportsnet. The show is produced by Warren Hansen, the one and only Amal Delek. Thank you. Mixed in sound. And our social media for Sportsnet is handled by Jonathan Brazzo. So thanks a lot, boys. You did well. You did very well this week, so you all get a gold star. And we'll be back next week with another episode of Inside Curling.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Jimmy.